Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, a podcast where we talk about the culture we love that society sometimes makes us feel bad about. I'm your host, the bodyguard who was on duty when President Reagan got shot, Caroline O'Donoghue. Joining me is author and queen of the night, Irene Sinekoji. Hi.
Hello, I'm so happy to be here.
I'm so happy you brought the bodyguard into my life.
Of course. Like, why wouldn't you want the bodyguard in your life? It's such a good film. So, yeah.
It's such a good film.
It really is.
So, or like for most of the episodes of this season, I've asked people and they've brought stuff that I already loved, already knew backwards, and it's been really easy. It's been a lazy job as a podcaster. And so when you came with The Bodyguard, and like I was born 1990, this came 92. Yeah. I was slightly too young to have seen it, but just old enough for the culture to meme it a lot. Like I remember being referenced on everything, was referenced on The Simpsons a lot.
Yeah.
So I got the secondhand knowledge of The Bodyguard, where I felt like I knew everything that you needed to know about it. But then watching it, I was like, this is so much of a better film than anyone ever gave it credit for.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It gets trashed online, yeah. But it's a really good film. And I came to it with a real passion for Whitney Houston. Mm. You know, I was such a massive Whitney fan. I remember listening to her album in boarding school and just, I was like, I loved her so much. And obviously the fact that she was going to be in this film, I remember it being advertised everywhere. So I had to see this film and I was, I think at school at the time. And it was just everywhere. Everybody was talking about it. She was the height of her powers as a star at the time. Kevin Costner was a big name. So, you know, the film, it was like a no-brainer for me to want to see it. And I loved it. Apparently, it's her first movie role as well.
But, right?
Yeah. So I was like, she did really well for a first-time performance, you know. But Kevin always had her in mind for the role.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I just love that he specifically asked for her. The film was originally supposed to have been made in the 70s with Diana Ross and Steve McQueen, mm-hmm. But the studios felt like it was too much of a risk. So then it got postponed. And then in the late 90s, it was supposed to be Diana Ross and Ryan O'Neill, who were actually having a hot romance at the time, but they fell out. So then the film again was put on the back burner. And then I think somehow Kevin had heard about this through the grapevine, loved the premise and the idea of it, and, you know, immediately felt like Whitney would be perfect for it. So, I mean, there's so much like trivia around the film as well.
It's such a rich feed. If you want, like, you can go for hours just finding like Kevin Costner in an interview saying some random story about it. I'm like, yeah, hook it into my veins. But I want to go back to boarding school or innocent and like, what was that like? So would you see it in the cinema? Like, what do you remember? Do you remember these like moments really hitting you in the chest, or did the love of it grow over the years?
Well, so my love for Whitney developed there, and I saw it, you know, when we were staying in London. But I had been loving her album. I'd been listening to her a lot. I loved her voice. It was so soulful and powerful. And then when the film came out, I was just... She looked stunning in it as well. I really liked the idea of it. You know, this bodyguard protecting this mercurial pop star. But also the fact that she was fully human in the film. You know, yes, she was tempestuous. Yes, she was troublesome. But she was also vulnerable as well. And she was also a mother, you know. And I love that we got to see that side I think that's important, that, you know, you have a woman who's living her dream, but not at the cost of anything. You know, so she gets to be a mother, but she also gets to be super successful. And actually, if you look at the power dynamic, it's skewed in her favor. She's the rich boss woman. She's paying him, you know, so for his services to protect her. So, you know, there's so much there that's interesting that kind of stood out to me. You know, as a young girl, I was like, yeah, this is really cool.
it's so cool. And like what you said as well about when you said Diana Ross, there's something that Diana Ross and Whitney share, which is a vulnerability. Mm. Like, you can see why Ms. Ross was like,
yeah,
was on the list for that, because there's something about their eyes and there's something about them that makes you want to protect them in this way, while simultaneously being these huge voices, these great singers, these huge performers. You still would like give your life so they feel no pain.
Yeah, you believe it, right?
You believe it.
That they need protecting. And yeah. I think, you know, you hit the nail on the head. Diana has a sweetness about her. You yeah. know, that voice, it's so singular, Diana's voice, actually. It's unlike anyone else's tone. So I can see why she would have been picked for it as well. And of course, Whitney is the complete opposite in terms of style, you know, powerhouse of a singer, but also I think has a vulnerability there as well. You know, also has a kind of innocence. I remember watching an interview with Kevin where he said that, you know, she always felt like, even though she was this big star, she never really, you know, she always had a vulnerability. She felt, will people like me? You know, am I good enough? And that just made me love her more, because, you know, that shows that, you know, no matter how successful she got, she always wanted to be appreciated. She never took any of that for granted. You know, she always felt like this still the girl, like from, you know, the sort of working class background, yeah, who grew up in the church, you know, and just wanted to do well and make people happy, really. So it would have been interesting to see what the movie would have been like with McQueen and Ross, like, yeah, in my movie fantasy land.
Like, still good, I think.
I think it would still have been really, really good. You know, you've got McQueen, who's cool as hell, and, you know, Diana, again, this wonderful star. I mean, it would have been lovely, I think, but yeah, we've got a great version.
There's this thing that Costner says about, and I think it might be in a really gorgeous eulogy he does.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Really beautiful.
Yeah.
Really respectful and really funny. It's very sweet. He seems like a very sweet man.
He seems like a really nice, considerate man, doesn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah. Yeah, like he does talk about himself a lot in the eulogy. Like, he tells these random stories. Like, me and Whitney both grew up in the church.
Yeah.
Here are some stories from my childhood in the church. And you're like, I think you've misunderstood the brief. But like, you know, he's been famous a long time. He's allowed himself involved.
Yeah.
But there's something he says, and it really broke my heart, because, of course, this movie is much more bittersweet now, because, you know, because Whitney, no one could protect her in
yeah.
the end, and you kind of, that sort of throbs through the movie now, that knowledge that she was this person who couldn't be protected ultimately. And he says something, is like, the thing that drove her greatness, which was, will I ever be good enough and will they like me,
yeah,
was also the architect of her downfall.
Yeah, and I that really struck yeah. me as well when I watched the speech, and I thought, God, that's such a spot on way of summing it up, because yeah. that, you know, her strength was also her Achilles heel, you know, is that desire to yeah. be liked, in a way, to feel good enough, even though you're hugely successful, you still don't feel like you're good enough. And there's something about, you know, the people who were around her that perhaps, you know, she was let down somewhat, I feel, yeah. in terms of being protected. She was extremely generous as a person, employed a lot of family members. They were, a lot of them were on the payroll.
Which is always, when you read that in a star's biography, you're like, oh no.
Yeah, exactly.
The call will come from inside the house.
Exactly. Don't do it. Get professional people around you, yeah. because, you know, there will be that distance. But I think that, you know, when you're surrounded by family in that sense, and it's work related, people don't necessarily have the onus to put you first, because they're earning money off it, you know. So it was just unfortunate for her that she must have felt so alone, you know,
yeah.
during those terrible last days, that, you know, unfortunately, she wasn't protected. And it makes it, like you said, all the more bittersweet, looking back at the film,
yeah.
actually. Yeah.
We'll get to it, but I'm just going to do the plot summary first. Frank Farmer is an ex-Secret Service agent who is currently between jobs when he's asked to bodyguard the R&B singer Rachel Maron, who is receiving threatening letters from a stalker. Rachel doesn't believe that she needs extra security and at first refuses to change her lifestyle to Frank's specifications. However, as the threats on her life increase, Rachel and Frank are forced together as she comes to rely on his protection. And the thing about this movie, it's kind of the perfect date movie. Back when that still existed as a concept. Back when people like went to the cinema every Friday night with their lover. Because it's got all this like really tantalizing, thrilling action and this gorgeous central romance that's not even hooked on a particular chemistry as much as it's based on proximity and need. You know, it's not like they have loads in common. They just have like a physical attraction.
Well, they're very different, aren't they?
Yeah.
But like you said, there is this chemistry that you feel between them and this kind of push and pull. You know, she knows that she needs his services, but at the same time, she's not making it very easy for him. Yeah. And she's being quite resistant, whereas he's somebody that likes to work with people who understand their situation and, you know, make it slightly easier for him to do what he needs to do. But he doesn't get that with her. He's quite introverted, you know, clearly intelligent, clearly very disciplined, you know.
And that's so hot.
Which is very sexy. And that makes sense for a bodyguard to be that way. Whereas she is the opposite, you know. She's extravagant. She's demanding. You know, she demands to be centered all the time. And you can see that that annoys him. But there's also an attraction there. You see that sort of beguiling romance developing, and it's really lovely to watch, you know. But like you said, that there's a thriller element as well with the threats on her life, and there are two kind of different storylines in that sense that, you know, that converge later on in the film. But I think in terms of having a good date movie, you have all those different aspects. So it's not just a romance, you know, and it's not just an action film, and it's not just a thriller. You get a whole mix of that, and that's what makes it really interesting.
And it also, it's just... And I think modern films about fame, and I think there are a lot, and there are a lot of TV shows at the moment. I was kind of ill recently and I ended up watching a lot of TV, and a lot of it happened to be about like, oh, this person who escaped into a famous person's world. And I think the mistake that those shows often make is they make it a little bit too glamorous and too shiny and too clean. Mm. What I really liked about this, because the movie really starts when he drives up to... When he accepts the job, he drives up to Rachel Maron's house. Also, when I was talking about this to my boyfriend, he said, Rachel Maron, that sounds like a daytime news presenter, not a pop star. Rachel Maron, the most famous pop star
in the
world.
It's an unfortunate surname, I think.
Just like, try harder.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But no, when he drives up, that I found that quite amusing. And he's saying all these things, you know, giving Henry Ford's name to...
Yes.
You know, to show how easy it is to kind of get
yes.
to have proximity to her and have access.
And there's this weather-beaten intercom where the
yeah.
It doesn't work properly. It's like crackling. And he's like, it's Thomas Edison. And he's just like saying bullshit into the thing.
Absolutely.
And they just let
and
him
they
in.
And they let him in. It's crazy. Yeah, no, in real life, would they do that?
But here's the thing.
That's the only thing. That was like the one red flag for me. It was like that moment. I was like, surely.
I think it does represent a different era of stardom where the information wasn't publicly available.
Possibly,
so people thought, well, if you have the dress and if you sound businesslike, then probably you have business.
Right,
here.
Right.
Buzz.
Then we'll let you in.
But this thing of like, and I think this is actually an accurate representation of how a lot of people like that live, where it's like, because they have, that it's... Often people like this, they get famous very, very quickly. They employ people who are close to them who aren't professionals and who, and like they buy these enormous properties that need a lot of maintenance, but to, you need to have so much infrastructure to help maintain that kind of thing. And I think movies about celebrity often get that wrong. There often is this kind of like fine, very tantalizing line between kind of griminess and glamour. And it's from the immediate he goes up to the house and like she's rehearsing her next music video in some wing of the house.
Yeah.
And there's like dust motes in the air.
Right, right.
It doesn't feel clean, but it does feel glamorous.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess in a way, like you're saying, it perhaps feels authentic.
Yeah, it
you
does.
Know, because, yeah, I mean, she doesn't have the right sort of security structure.
Yeah.
Even staff-wise, I think she has one guy. who's like this huge bear of a man. Very quite dodgy as a security
guy. I love that guy.
Yeah, he was lovely.
He has a real arc within the film.
He goes on a journey.
He does. Here's the thing, every single character in The Bodyguard is really there for a reason. There are no extraneous characters.
Very true.
So we have our lead two, Kevin Costner and Whitney Houston. I'm probably going to refer to them as Kevin and Whitney.
Yeah,
I'm probably totally not going to say Rachel Marin again very much.
I think that's fine.
I think it's fine. We have her sister Nikki.
Yeah.
Her jealous sister Nikki, who was the singer first.
I liked Nikki.
I loved Nikki.
I really liked Nikki. Yeah.
We have the sort of music manager from the label with the tiny blonde ponytail. We have her head of security, who's like this sort of big Italian guy who, again, goes on a journey. And I completely believe him from the instant because he just says, you know, Rachel likes the way I do things.
Yeah, absolutely. And you could see that being the reality. Like, who is this new guy like coming onto my territory and trying to tell me how to run things? I've been here. You don't know what you're talking about. I know the score. So that resistance is immediately believable. You know, that hostility that he has. So, yeah. No, he's so... It's like he wasn't acting for me, I felt.
Yeah,
like,
I don't believe that. He was just born doing that.
Very natural, I thought, that performance. He really captured that role really well.
And for a movie that like has been campified and referenced and all, I find the performance is very natural.
Yeah. Yeah,
and like,
definitely.
What's so great, we kind of the sort of, he's sort of looking around, and the movie's really good at showing Rachel's world through his eyes. And it's like, he's not clocking the success.
He's looking at the vulnerabilities and the vulnerabilities from the offset.
Yeah. He's just like, anybody can get in here. There are so many people in this room. I don't know what any of their roles are. Yeah. Does she know? Like... And then it just like, he just follows her and he only sees the back of her for the first couple of frames.
Yeah, that's true.
And then when you just, she turns around and you get that face.
That moment and that face, yeah. And you just want the camera does linger a bit.
It does.
And it's lovely. And then you get that look, you know, between them, that exchange. And it's, I don't know, that first moment, it feels really potent to me watching it. And you're just intrigued. You know, to kind of follow these two characters and what happens, but also his sense of, I don't know, vulnerability in that space as well, because he's used to bodyguarding politicians, maybe not necessarily somebody like Whitney, or if somebody like that, somebody like we said earlier, who understands what needs to be done, but somebody like this character who's feisty and you know, sort of difficult to manage, is going to be a problem for him. you can see that, you know, and she's talking to everybody except him, really, after that first introduction. I mean, what a way to dismiss somebody. They've specifically come to meet you. You know, they've come to meet you. There's the introduction's made, and then you just go back as if nothing's happened, you know. So you know, like from that moment, it's going to be fascinating to watch their relationship and how it develops.
I imagine in 1992, there were so many people who showed up to the cinema being like, "Well, can Whitney Houston act?" And like, I watched it, and I don't even know if she can act, but I do know, I do know she has this like indefinable something on screen.
She's very watchable, you know.
She's so natural.
She has a star quality that, you know, some people have it or they don't. And obviously she went on to do more film roles after The Bodyguard, and she was good in those roles. You know, Waiting to Exhale particularly was great for her, and Angela Bassett and all the other women, and that was brilliant. You know, but with this film as her first role, you can imagine, you know, the studio are taking a big risk putting her as the lead with no acting experience. But I think it's that quality, you know, that she had. And Kevin talks about it in his speech at her funeral, like having this really special quality that
it's like old Hollywood.
Yeah.
That sparkle, that Marilyn Monroe
glamour
moment.
Exactly. Yeah, that it's just like, wow, whatever it is you're doing, I cannot take my eyes off you the screen.
And for some reason, I kept thinking of like those 1950s starlets and like Monroe in particular when I was looking at her perform, because it is this thing of like the stunning face, but also this kind of like childlike.
That
makes you want to protect them.
Yeah. And oh my God, Monroe was so incredible. You know, so incredible as an actress as well, I think. And a brilliant woman, you know, really, really intelligent. Very well read.
Joyce. You know, everyone's in the picture of her reading Joyce.
Yeah, very well read. And, you know, really masterminded her career as well from the offset. I think a lot of people don't give her credit for that. People talk a lot about her looks, and she was absolutely drop dead gorgeous, but also very, very shrewd. Clearly, again, very vulnerable. This is something that we see with, you know, with starlets and famous women in the limelight,
which is why their images endure, because they might fade or die, but our urge to protect them never does.
This is so true. And you felt the same way about Whitney as well. Like, you know, as a fan, like watching her, I always was like, God, I hope she'll be okay, because we all knew the personal demons, you know, we all knew about them, and you just hope that you wouldn't hear, you know, that it would be tragedy one day, you know, and we all wanted her to be looked after, but you don't have any control over that. It, you know, when you're that famous and that successful, you know, it just goes to show that, how do you define happiness? How do you define success when you've achieved it? And you've achieved it at that level, like, where else is there for you to go in a way that makes you feel challenged, fulfilled, and just happy? You know, and who's around you that makes you feel, you know, supported? If you have a partner, for example, that's absolutely batshit. Barbie. you know, who's batshit. Also talented, but I think was also very jealous of Whitney as well. You know, if I can say that, watching the documentary about her life and their time together, you know, he wasn't good for her, unfortunately.
I love how, like, we're still saying that. Like, 20 years later, we're still like, he was not good for her.
Although, to be fair to him, it was her choice. She wanted to be in that relationship. You know, she wanted to be with him very badly.
Yeah. But there's this thing that becomes very evident in the movie when we talk about protecting, which is what this movie is about. It's this thing of, like, immediate question that the film throws up, which is, who is he protecting her from? Mm. Is he protecting her from these very disturbing stalker things and these bomb threats she's getting? Or is she protecting her from these leeches within her own home who are... It's really interesting. I think this movie has so much to say about fame.
Mm.
Because when we're around famous people, and I've seen this happen, where it's like everyone is very invested in the famous person's short-term happiness.
Right.
Because it means their short-term gain.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they don't know when they're going to get cut off the feeding tube, right? And so when it comes to like getting the person what they want immediately, or getting rid of something they don't like immediately, that's very easy and people do it very quickly. But when it comes to the long-term gain, which is pushing back on someone, letting them know there's limitations, letting them know they aren't center of the world, you know, depriving them of drugs or booze or food or whatever, you know, because they need someone pushing back. That is those are the first people that leave a famous person's life.
Definitely. They get rid of them.
They get rid of them.
You're not a yes person.
Exactly, because there will always be an outnumbered yes person ratio that can slowly vote out the
absolutely
pushback, right?
And I guess it depends on, you know, your position within that chain as well. Like, how powerful are you within that? You know, if you're somebody like a Frank, then you know, you have some authority in a way, I think, to kind of hold fast in that role, because you've been brought in specifically to protect her. So he's not only protecting her from those threats, but also herself. Like you said, it's the self-destruction that can happen with these people, where it's about, actually, you need boundaries. You need to have boundaries. And if you won't have them for yourself, I'm going to have to help you enforce them. So we see that in the film, where he's like, no, actually, you need to let me know what your plans are so that we can prepare for it. You know,
we need cameras.
We need cameras. Yeah. Exactly. So there are structures that he starts to have in place to help protect her from these kind of self-destructive tendencies where she's like, well, I can just go out as I please and do, but yeah. you can't, not when we're getting these threats. And of course, there is the sort of internal threat as well that yeah. we see, you know, develop, and the kind of the sibling rivalry between the sisters. And we have to talk about Nikki because she's such a good character. She's such a good character. And she's the opposite, you know, to yeah. Rachel, in that she's quiet and she's humble, you know, also clearly a bright woman.
Yeah.
You know, clearly intelligent, clearly has desires. Also, you know, had aspirations to be a singer, actually started the whole thing in the family.
That I love that scene when yeah. he's in her room with her or something, and she's sort of showing her that, like, yeah. oh, I play guitar. And
absolutely.
And then there's like, you know, we're kind of jumping ahead a little bit here, but there's that scene where they're in the kind of winter paradise segment of the film, the winter wonderland.
I like the winter wonderland.
I love the winter wonderland.
Wasn't it great? I was like, oh, I could just stay in this part of the movie for like 40 minutes.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
And I loved his dad as well. I was like, oh my God, his dad is so wonderful.
Okay, I think actually we're getting too far ahead. I think we need to work back and we need to work.
We're getting too excited. It's too exciting.
Let's work through chronologically, because an important element of this movie is that, and it's back to what we were saying about like the sort of cloud of, you know, delusion that people who are around famous people allow them to create, which is Rachel doesn't know the severity of the threat level.
Yeah.
And nobody will tell her because nobody wants her to see her upset. You know, no one wants to freak her out. And because if Rachel were to be freaked out, it means maybe she wouldn't go on stage and then nobody gets paid.
Exactly. Right?
Not really about her personal.
No, it's about them.
Yeah. And
really.
And the level of the threat becomes clear then at the fucking one of the best scenes in cinema. When she goes to like a small club.
Yeah, it's a really cool scene.
To promote Queen of the Night, her new single.
Love that song.
I got the stuff that you
want. That you need.
So good.
Yeah, really, really good scene. And also, like, can we just talk about her outfit? There's something very sort of sci-fi-ish, yeah. Afro-futurist happening there, where it's like, it's slightly otherworldly.
It's,
isn't it?
So cool.
It's really cool.
So she goes on stage wearing a hood.
Yeah.
Which again, sci-fi. And then she takes, she whips it off. Yeah. And it's like, what I wrote down was like a cyborg Josephine Baker.
This is it. Absolutely spot on. Like she looks part machine, part cyborg, part human, and very gorgeous. I'm like, ooh.
And there's like this video in the background that's doing this kind of chop and change of all these images. And some of them are like old school images and some of them are just like eyeballs and stuff. And it like,
it's all quite weird and frenetic. There's that going on.
Yeah. It's very Blade Runner or something. It's very, it feels like the club houses the undead.
Yeah. Yeah, I love this. I love that club scene. I thought it was so, so good.
And it's so good because it's the first time that we have these two characters where, and I think this is kind of the most interesting thing about the movie is that they have these two sort of MOs that are deliberate. They're very conflicting because we have the star who has built her career, and this happens with all stars, on a sort of a sense of not just their voice and their music, but their relatability, how their audience feels about them, how if I go to a Rachel Maron concert, I can, and we all do this at some level when we go to see somebody perform in concert, we want to feel close to them.
Yeah.
ultimately we could listen to Spotify at home. But we want that essence. We want something from them to be delivered to us.
We want to know them more.
Right, and
that's how we do it.
That's what sells tickets, right? And so Rachel needs to keep towing this line where she's giving her fans just enough, but then Farmer is just like, you need to be safe.
Yeah.
and there's this great thing where she's on stage and she's dancing and this guy tries to get up and dance with her and she dances with him and Costner is like storming on and she puts her hand, she keeps putting her hand to stop
him from coming on. Yeah, because she wants, like you said, she wants to be able to give her fans that access and she enjoys that. I think she's a celebrity who doesn't want to be remote from her fans. Like, she wants her audience to know her, and she's you know, she seems very unpretentious, I think, as a celebrity. She doesn't wear any, she's very confident, but she doesn't have airs and graces. You know, she likes to feel relatable. You know, we see her in the movie signing stuff, I think, for kids who approach her. So she wants that. That's an important part of the Rachel Maron image, you know, hence doing this small secret club as well, like, rather than, you know, I guess doing it something in a much bigger space. Again, like, that's all part of it, like that cool, accessible edge.
Yes, which, you know, after a certain point, and there's a reason that famous people, despite the fact that they are treated like companies, can't be companies. Because with a company, you're expecting an exponential growth year on year. But when the focus of that entire operation is a single person who has to remain relatable but global.
Yeah.
And like artistic but listenable.
Yeah.
And like,
yeah. How do you tow that line?
You can't. It's impossible. It's which really, is why really these hard. People go crazy and die.
No wonder they go nuts. Yeah. Because it's that. That's it. That's the essence. It's trying to appeal to all of that, you know, to achieve all of that. And it's so hard. It's so difficult without compromise, losing your soul, losing your sense of self, going nuts behind the scenes, all of that, you know. And we see her explode several times, don't we? We see her kind of just combust because it's just all too much, you know, in those moments where reality hits. Because I think that her team, like you said, are very good at keeping that distance in terms of the threat that's coming.
Yeah.
Not fully letting her know how bad it actually is.
Yeah.
And then when we have those moments where it's revealed, like, she can't handle it. And she lashes out, of course, at Frank.
Yeah. Because again, he's the only person who's there for like the long-term safety of the person involved. Right,
exactly.
Rather than the short-term.
He doesn't have an agenda beyond doing his job and making sure that she is, you know, she's as safe as possible. So it's really, really fascinating. I love the contrast between the sisters.
Yeah,
because it just adds again another dimension, both to Rachel's character and her sister Nikki, who we see has like wants and desires as well. Yeah. And, you know, she's withering away in this space. She's withering. Honestly, in her sister's world, where she also works for her, you know, you can see that her needs aren't being met, you know.
Now, Renaton, I believe you live with your sister. Was she an acclaimed short story writer?
I made sure that didn't happen. No. No, I absolutely adore my sister. She's
the day you got your MBE, your sister's like getting stoned and going to a random bar.
No, she was so thrilled for me because she's such a like wonderful human being and just, really lovely. I mean, we're super close. She's also creative, actually. But, you know, she's always been supportive and I'm supportive of her as well. You know, I think that helps a lot. Yeah. Even if you have similar interests, you know, and my mother did this thing when we were girls of dressing us exactly the same.
Really?
Oh my God. Yeah. That happened a lot when we were kids. It was like, we're in the same dress again for photos. Oh my God.
What's the age difference between you two?
So 3 years difference.
All right. Yeah. So my sister, who gets mentioned on the podcast quite a lot, there's 10 years between us, but she trained to be a journalist first.
Oh, wow.
So she's kind of my Nikki.
Oh, I see. You got the idea from her.
Well, kind of. I do think the sister thing is really important because, like, you know, when I think of like all the, like what I'm doing right now on this podcast, the sort of like pop cultural dissection. She taught me that because she learned all that at university.
That's amazing.
She taught me that like ordinary people like us could be, you know, journalists or in the media or whatever. And even though she didn't ultimately pursue those things herself, like she like blazed this machete through the long grass for me to follow, you
That's
know?
Amazing. That's amazing. And I love that. I love that she did that and that she's probably so proud of you.
She
you
really
know.
Is. Oh, she's great. I love her. Hi, Jill.
That's wonderful. This is, just makes me feel so good. And I think it just gives you that confidence as well, you know, when you have that support. And, you know, you're also like really straight, like upfront about things that piss you off about each other as well, you know. So, you see, I don't know, in the film, I think it's interesting that Rachel is so expressive, you know, but Nikki isn't.
Yeah, she's very muted.
She's very muted and she internalizes everything, you know, and you see that that starts to take its toll a bit on her later on in the film.
Isn't it funny how like there are so many artistic women who also have like sisters, like the Brontes, like three geniuses.
It's incredible.
Three geniuses who would have redefined like English literature regardless of where they came from, and they also happen to be sisters.
It's amazing.
Like I think sisterly rivalries are like the most potent and powerful thing.
Yeah, there's something about that space that makes you want to be your best. Like absolutely.
Like in the Williams sisters.
Yeah, you know? Same thing, you know, watching them as well. I mean, amazing. Incredible.
Nikki just needed to step up and be Serena.
Yeah, that is one of the things looking at the film. I wish that things hadn't, you know, for her, things had, you know, been better in a way, and that she had been able to tap into, you know, her spirit, because there was something there, I feel.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, that got lost, you know.
Let's move through chronologically to the scene where Whitney asks him out.
Oh,
in her jogging gear.
I know, you know, she's kind of badass, just sort of,
she's
just like,
so badass.
I know what I want. And right now you've been annoying me, but actually you're quite attractive, and actually I think I might want to go on a date with you. But there's a way she becomes very flirty in that moment, and a little bit shy and a little bit awkward, and I think
so cute.
It's really cute, and I think she endears herself to him somewhat in that moment, you know, because he's kind of shy as well, you know, even though he's very professional.
Yeah.
He's shy romantically, isn't he? He doesn't seem like he's comfortable.
No, he doesn't. And there's this thing where like their only real flirty scene before she asks him out in her jogging gear is is when he goes shopping with her and she's like, can you get me this and a
like,
six?
No.
And he's like, I'm here to protect you and I help you shop. And it's like the thing of like she's getting changed.
Yeah.
Over the door. It's all very, it's very snappy. It's
it is.
I like it because he is like, he's not particularly a talkative character, but they do give him good lines.
He has good lines, but also there's so much left unsaid with him.
Yeah.
And I think Kevin Costner pulls that off really, really well. You know, there's a lot going on under the surface. Like you can see him sort of ruminating on this dynamic between them. You know, there's a scene also where he's like watching a music video of her. I think this is before she asks him out, and he is almost just like completely absorbed watching it, and she can see from her balcony because she can hear her singing.
She's watching him watch her.
And I was like, that's sexy.
Hot. It's
I was
so
like,
hot.
This is really hot.
It's something about like this like sort of, I think most women have a sort of a sexually voyeuristic vibe to them, because I think we so grow up looking at women that men find desirable, right? So we're almost channeling our sexual desire through male eyes all the time, the male gaze, I believe they call it. And and so like when you're watching a man watch a version of you that's been made for his gaze, but he doesn't know you're there. There's something really erotic about that.
And powerful.
Yeah.
And powerful, because now she has this knowledge.
Yeah.
And I think that gives her the confidence
and
the power to say, I want him. I want him.
Yeah.
And I'm going to voice that.
I'm pretty sure he wants me.
And I think he wants me. God damn it. You know.
And the way she says it to him, she's like, So if I were to go on a date, you'd be there and that would be awkward. So I might as well date you. You dig? And she's like, okay.
I love that she did that. It's very funny. It's
very good.
Very good. It's like, yeah, you know, it's going to be awkward. So let's just get around that.
Cut out the middleman.
Are you dating me? How do you feel about that?
Oh. How do you feel about their days?
Oh, okay. So I like their dates.
I like their dates.
Sweet. It's very sweet. I love that they went to see Seven Samurai, which is a cult film. And again, that draws parallels between what he does and that world, which I thought was really clever and interesting. But I love the scene when she's back at his place and the samurai sword is almost a tool of seduction, you know, and it's kind of like you're seeing the brutality of it, but also it's tender in that scene. It's sort of sensual, you know, where he removes her scarf and then he throws it onto the sword and she's got the sword pointed at his chest. And I mean, there's all sorts of metaphors going on there. And then, and then the scarf splits on the sword and it's just like, I don't know, there's a lovely tension there. Really nice to watch.
When the scarf splits on the sword, it's so erotic.
Very sexy.
I don't understand.
I had that reaction too.
I was like, why am I so turned on? Two inanimate objects.
I know. I was like, what's going on here? Like, this is really sensual. No, I thought that was really, really lovely. And also, like, her teasing information out of him, you know, throughout the date, she's steering it once again. Yeah. Her power in
her
that
power
comes through. You know, she knows what she wants. She wants to get to know him. She wants him to open up more.
Yeah.
And she does that, you know, and you can see he's, I don't know if flourishing is the word I would use, but you can see him starting to open up a bit more.
That bit where he's like, yeah, I've liked a girl before. She's like, oh, what? Did she die?
Yeah.
So something I would do.
It's so funny as well. I was like, oh, what? Did she die?
And he's like, yeah, she died. And she's like, no. And he was like, no, she didn't die. She just didn't like me back. It was so good.
Yeah, it was really good. And then she was like, I can't imagine that. Or something along those lines. Yeah. And I was like, ooh, you're good.
So good.
Really good.
I just wish they showed more of the sex.
Yeah, this is what's
so rarely want more sex in a film. I generally prefer it being a suggestion and me using my imagination. But in this case, I wanted to see some torso and tit.
Yeah, no, I felt the same, actually. Yeah, I think maybe we got, what, maybe three?
We got more of the scarf.
Yeah, we didn't really get enough, I think, sex scenes-wise. Yeah. But it left you wanting more. And they had such good chemistry that, I don't think that would have been an issue, but I don't know.
Then, this pissed me off. Then she wakes up in the morning and she's like, hey, big guy.
Yeah. You ready to rock and roll?
You're ready to rock and roll? And he's like, oh, there's such a good line where he's like, you know, no, I let my guard down. I can't protect you if I'm dating you. And would you understand or whatever? And she's incensed.
She's furious.
Yeah. And he's just like, well, look, you can live with it or you can fire me. And she goes, but I can't fuck you.
Yeah, that's a great line.
And it's so good. I love the way that this is a woman who is like a mother, like a good mother on screen.
Clearly, yeah.
And they let, the film allows her to be difficult and horny in a way that's actually very rare.
And also to express desire.
Yeah.
In a way that, you know, like you understand, you know, she's a woman attracted to this man and they have this connection and she wants to develop it more. You know, it's a bit like, oh, yeah, we've had this intimacy and now, you know, I can't pursue it because I can't protect you. I mean, you can understand it. Like you said, you can understand it. But I just, part of me felt like, come on, man, just...
Come on.
Just roll with it for a bit. The
thing is, you want to say, lighten up, but also
come on, buddy.
Immediately things get more dangerous and you're like, okay, maybe don't lighten up.
No, from his perspective, it makes sense that, you know, he feels like he can't be operating at optimum level if he has this, you know, sexual relationship with her.
Yeah,
and it means that, you know, his head's going to be all over the place. But from her perspective, she's like, no, I want you and I want us to continue doing what we're doing. Why are you saying no to me?
Why are you being a loser? Basically, is what she says to him.
Yeah.
Why are you being a loser? There's something that I'm quite fascinated with, the sort of like background context of this movie, which is that assassinations were very in the public consciousness, right, during this time. So this thing that comes back to a lot was that he was in Secret Service and he protected Carter and Reagan. And then the thing that keeps coming up is, well, he Reagan got shot. Yeah. Like, yeah, well, not when I
was. Yeah, I love that line. Not it's when so, I was there.
Yeah, not when I was there. Yeah, it's so funny because he was burying his mom. And this thing. So I thought about it and I was like, okay, so like the original script of this was written in the 70s, right? And, you know, there's Reagan, there's, I'm not sure exactly when that happened, but like, you know, Martin Luther King and like all these American civil rights activists.
JFK.
Yeah. And then like a bit later in the 80s, John Lennon and Andy Warhol.
Yeah.
Like people were getting assassinated. Assassination was at the front of the culture's mind.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, what?
But I think
this might be not a question for you or for me, but I'm just going to put it out there. How come we never hear about assassinations anymore? It's all mass shootings now. It's all just blanket shootings, assassinations.
In the way that things shift in the culture, I think it's just changed. You know, like you said, now we have like these terrible shootings and mass shootings that happen. But assassinations at those times, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, they had an almost mythic quality to them. And I think that's, you know, that's what the film was capturing as well, in a sense, that kind of that he was in that world. You know, he was a part of that sort of, you know, orbit where these kind of terrible assassinations happened. And they not only affected the people, but, you know, around, but also the culture. Like everybody was talking about JFK for years and decades. And also that we still have a fascination with these assassinations, you know, post the time period. There's something about it, I think, that really leaves an imprint on the culture. And there's something intriguing as well, especially if it's unsolved, you know, if we don't know. I mean, the JFK, I mean, there have been so many angles about his assassination and what happened, you know, and it's all really
interesting. Oh, it's never going away.
It's never going to go.
It's my dad's happy place thinking about that assassination.
This is what I'm saying. It's like it never goes away. You know, all the conspiracy theories, there's so much there. So I think there's something really still at the time when the film came out.
Yeah.
In that, yes, we had moved on somewhat, but there's something still potent about that.
You know what is
that aspect?
Well, so physical assassinations—they're not really in the cultural conversation right now. But you know what is? Character assassinations.
So true.
People are obsessed with the idea of someone's character being derided publicly in a really like directed way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you know what I mean? This idea of like, oh, someone, you know, someone said or did something bad and then something old that they did was dug up by a mercenary.
Right,
and then
right.
It was plugged into the Daily Mail or whatever and now it's over for them.
And it's like their career is done. Yeah,
that is scarier to us now than being shot.
That's so true because there's so much power as well.
I just read today that they're remaking The Bodyguard.
Oh, I saw that.
Yeah, I tweeted you last night.
You mentioned that to me, yeah.
Okay, so 2022's The Bodyguard is somebody going up to Zendaya and saying, Zendaya, they found an old tweet.
That is so spot on. And she's like, no!
No! Yes. You used a series of slurs to describe an American Idol
what
finale.
What were you thinking? That is absolutely hilarious.
And then, like, it wouldn't be her bodyguard. It'd be, like, her social media manager she falls in love with.
Yeah.
Zendaya, I'm doing this to protect you. I can tweet how I want.
You're not allowed to tweet for this amount of time. I'm protecting you.
If I should stay.
Oh my God, that's absolutely
so good.
So good. So, so good. But I don't know. How do you feel about a remake? I mean, I'm not sure. It could be good. It could be, if they do something different with it, I think.
I was thinking about this exactly, about like, what if it was a gender flipped one?
Interesting.
Right? And it's like someone protecting like a Justin Bieber type.
Interesting.
And the protector, the bodyguard, is Missy Elliott.
No way! Oh my God!
Because like Missy Elliott would fucking fuck you up.
She would mess you up. And she'd pull some amazing moves as well while at it.
Missy Elliott protecting Justin Bieber and they fall in love.
And make some amazing music behind the scenes.
It would be so good!
I would pay to watch that. I would I've absolutely watched that. I love how your brain works, honestly. Just
Missy Elliott driving up to Justin Bieber's house.
Could somebody write this movie now?
Me.
You should write it.
It should be me.
You should totally write it. Oh my God. Just like, oh goodness me.
Missy Elliott being like, it's Thomas Edison.
It's a static.
Yeah. So good. Movie roles for Missy is what we need.
That needs to happen. She's incredible. So
yeah, she definitely has the star quality. I don't even need to see a screen test.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. No, yeah. Honestly, innovative as well, I think.
Yeah.
In terms of like what she was doing back in the day. But yeah, that's a whole nother conversation.
I would do a sentimental garbage in Missy Elliott, but there's no garbage there. There's no one's ever come for Missy Elliott.
There's only good stuff.
There's only good stuff.
Yeah.
There's no like fight to fight.
There's nothing to argue.
Yeah. So, okay. So then we get to this period of the movie where they're not speaking to each other and they're having a shit time and Rachel's going to some event, I don't know. but this is, it goes to this whole thing where they're in like a rented suite in a hotel somewhere.
Yeah.
And
we're not sure where it is.
Yeah. For me, this storyline is a little weak. So there's this thing of like this guy, Secret Service, former Secret Service guy that Frank used to work with, who's got the face of a villain.
Yeah, he definitely has a face for radio.
Just like just like with scars and weird eyes and all
weird
this.
Expressions.
Everything about him is like wronging. It's so telegraphed.
You would be alarmed if he wouldn't you?
Yeah.
You'd be like, I don't trust that guy.
You would not. Yeah, no. And then she sort of takes him into her bedroom to sort of get back at Frank, being like, well, I'm going to basically fuck your peer to get back at you, which is a fucking cold thing to do.
Very cold.
Very cold.
Yeah.
And then it turns very dark. He tries to rape her and then he is seen out of the building. And then that is supposed to be sort of the stimulus for him being the murderer. There's this whole thing. We might as well get into these stories, spoilers, because I've only seen this film once and you've seen it several times.
Yeah.
And I don't understand this. So this whole thing is that the stalker is a person who's been paid by Nikki, because Nikki wants to get Rachel killed because she has wilted into this horrid creature of resentment. That I understand.
Mm.
But then shortly thereafter, as we're about to discuss, Nikki becomes murdered. Nikki becomes murdered.
She gets murdered. Oh.
She gets murdered. It's sad.
Very sad.
And then shortly after confessing all of this, but then it's like, oh, it was never Nikki's thing, it's this other guy. And there's, can you explain it to me?
So as I understood it, she went into a bar in LA to hire a killer.
Yeah.
And it was done through this guy who never told her who the killer, who the hired hand would be.
Yeah.
And the hired hand ends up being Frank's peer.
Yes.
So that's how I understood that storyline.
Yes.
In terms of that, and then I guess the stalker is a separate weird guy who's just obsessed with her. And you know, in that confession scene where she's talking to Frank and admitting everything, he asked her about that, and she says, "I don't know about him. He's reading my mind. You know, maybe he's reading my mind." And that was really powerful to me. The fact that this stalker is saying these terrible, horrible things about Rachel, and Nikki felt like in some way some sort of affinity with him because she is having such a horrible time.
It feels oddly gothic, doesn't it?
Yeah, they're absolutely.
It's very a story you would write. It's very.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. No, this thing of like, because the stalker, who's a separate thing to the hitman, which is what's confusing.
Yeah, I can see why that's confusing, because I was a bit confused at first, and then I was like, oh, okay, this is what's happening.
Yeah, they could have worked.
They
on
could
that
have
bit.
Done that better. Yeah,
yeah. He's sending these letters that are the classic cutout from magazines, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
and they all say like, because her song is "I Have Nothing." It's like, "You have everything, I have nothing.
Yeah.
It ends for you now, bitch," or something. And that's the thing that Nikki's responding to. She's like, that's how, because that's exactly how she feels.
Yeah.
And why she got the hitman.
Exactly.
And then these letters appear and she's like, fuck.
Yeah. Like, yeah. What's going on?
Yeah.
But also he's capturing how I'm feeling.
Yeah.
So, you know, that really powerful scene where she's confessing everything, in a way, it kind of it makes you have such empathy for her that even though she's done this terrible thing where she's absolutely betrayed her sister and hired, you feel sorry for her.
You do.
And I think the movie does a really good job of foreshadowing that, because we get all these little moments where we see her, you know, she even makes a move on Frank.
Yeah.
You know, because she actually also finds Frank attractive from the offset. So both of them, both sisters were attracted to him. It's just that he went for Rachel.
It's
the story of her life. And it's like, God damn it, it's happened again.
This is it. Done.
This is it. You know, even in this instance, she wins. You know,
there's this great scene just before that, because now we're firmly in Winter Wonderland.
Oh, I love Winter Wonderland.
It's the best part of the movie.
It's brilliant. Oh, I love it. I love it. And I love his dad
it's
as well.
So Instagram porn, isn't it?
Like, it's beautiful.
Oh my God, his dad's interior choices.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
Incredible.
Gorgeous.
So they go to his like dad's winter lodge and to protect Rachel, and they all frolic in the snow. And there's this great scene where like Nikki is on the porch and she's like singing some gospel hymn.
Yeah.
And it's really beautiful and it's really sweet.
Yeah.
And then Rachel comes out and like puts her arms around her and she just wants to sing with her sister.
Yeah.
But her voice is so much better.
Her voice is so amazing. And you like watching it, you're so happy for Nikki that she gets this moment. And then a part of you dies. You can feel her soul dying because once again, Rachel comes and steals the moment. Even though, like
it's
you said,
it's a personal moment.
Personal moment, you know, you see that intimacy. She puts her arms around her. She loves her sister. You know, Rachel doesn't think there's any problem here. That's what's interesting about all this. So we have all of this happening on several different levels, like this massive resentment that she can't feel or sense. You know, she just thinks that they're close and that everything's fine. But again, it's another moment where she steals the show, and it just, you know, that it hits home. Like you really feel Nikki's loneliness.
And the thing is, like, the actress who plays Nikki, she doesn't register a great facial change.
Mm.
It's like her eyes just go kind of slightly blank.
Yeah.
You know, it's like fuck this bitch ruining my snowy morning.
Go away!
It's like really subtle.
Very subtle.
A movie that had to communicate a lot to a lot of people, it's a very subtle performance. It gets instantly unsubtle when he's interrogating her.
Yeah.
And he's like, why are you doing this? And she just goes, I was very stoned.
That line killed me.
I was very stoned.
I don't know. like she had to kind of be on the edge to go through with it, you know.
Yeah.
But I feel like Nikki would have done it regardless of whether she was stoned or not. I just, you know, I feel like she was getting to that point where it was just kind of too absorbing, the feeling of resentment and anger, like that quiet rage that spills over in that scene where she confesses. For you to cross that line and go and hire somebody, something's gone very, very wrong.
It's so soapy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's soapy. Very soapy. You know, it's like, but again,
it's soapy's
like,
choice.
but just that Rachel's clueless about all of this. I mean, I feel like, I don't know if it speaks to Rachel being really super self-absorbed, possibly, because as successful, famous people I want to be.
Yeah.
But I feel like if my sister was resentful towards me, I would be able to pick that up.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because especially when you're close, I'm sure it's the same thing. Like, you know, it comes out one way or another. Certainly with me and my sister when we've had...
It is very hard to hide your emotions from family members.
Yeah, you know, so it's just... It's interesting to me that Rachel never picks up on that, you know, that she, there's never any sort of, I don't know, like attention from her perspective towards her sister in that way. You know, you don't see it. It's all focused around her.
Yeah.
It's always all about her needs. And, you know, we know that she loves her sister. We see that. But it's just, it's interesting that that wasn't part of the film.
Yeah, because then we go... Nikki's murdered right after that, and the film spends very little time mourning her.
The film does not care about Nikki.
I care about Nikki.
But we
care. You care about Nikki.
I care about Nikki. Like, I like this character. Yeah. I warmed to her and I felt sorry for her, you know. And I mean, obviously we get the very sad stoic funeral scene afterwards, you know. Yeah. But again, like, it's not much lingered.
But even then, there's a kind of there's a voiceover from a news broadcaster. Mm. It's like, Nicky Marin, sister to Rachel. You know,
yeah,
it's like,
it's impersonal. It's, yeah.
But it's that immediate thing of that even in death, she's always going to be Rachel Marin's sister.
Yeah.
And it's like,
yeah.
Marin says this will not prevent her appearance at the Oscars.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, oh, great. Yeah, it's like, even in death, Nikki is not a person in her own life. Even in this film, where she is one of five characters, yeah, she's not important.
We feel bad for Nikki.
Rough. And then there's this whole thing at the Oscars, which is very exciting and also a blur to me. Mm. But it feels very realistic, this whole backstage Oscars-y-ness.
Mm. And the whole operation behind it and, like, yeah, you know, the sort of pressure and anxiety to make everything look picture perfect, and yes, there's all this chaos going on behind the scenes, and that actually felt like you got a glimpse into that world. It felt real to me actually.
Yeah,
because obviously we only see like the glamour. Yeah. We don't get to see the behind the scenes,
the stress of it,
the inner workings of it. But it's like, all these people seem really bloody stressed out. They don't seem like they're having a good time.
It does not seem like a happy
night. Yeah.
And this thing, it's really good where it's, she has to announce a category and then she has to go off screen and then go back to her seat and then win or whatever. Mm-hmm. But when she's announcing the category, she starts freaking out because Frank Farmer has made her so freaked out, and she opens the envelope and all she can see is the threatening notes that she got, and she thinks everyone in the audience is about to assassinate her, and she just pegs it off.
Yeah. legs it off.
I just kept thinking, like, imagine if that happened at the real Oscars and like an actress just pegged it off screen.
Oh my goodness. You would be
the
like,
memes would be,
what is going on? You know, like, I feel like, yeah, now in like a matter of hours, there'd be an explanation, obviously, for
yeah,
what was
but the
going
gifts
on.
Would go on forever.
Oh my god,
it
endless,
would be photoshopped onto endless, everything.
Yeah, it'd be a running yeah. joke, and yeah,
it'd be like, oh, me when the Zoom call ends.
Yeah, this is it.
It would be memed to perfection. I'm sad it's not real.
Oh my god, that's so true. But yeah, also, I guess, captures her sense of terror. You know, that like yeah. that threat actually has finally come to roost in a way that, like, the most important night of her career for her, she dreamed about being at the Oscars. She talks in the film with Frank Farmer. There's a really tender scene at night where she talks about betting her friends as kids that one day she was going to be at the Oscars, and, yeah. you know, how important it is for her to be there on the night and not be run out of it. And, you know, obviously he agrees that, yeah, you're going to go and I'm going to protect you. But then for that to just really badly start to go wrong. And again, she kind of unleashes at Frank because yeah. she's so scared and paranoid.
And hates him for making her paranoid as well.
Yeah.
He's really, yeah. yeah, as you say, he really has taken roost in her brain.
Absolutely. Even though he's doing his job, you know, that yeah. he's supposed to make her aware that, you know, they can't mess about with this threat. It could happen at any time.
Yeah.
You know, but she is still very, very resentful of the fact that she has to live this way.
Yeah.
You know, and that it all kind of comes to fruition in that scene where she sort of just can't take it and rushes off stage and just like pegs it.
And then just pegs it. I love that phrase. really gives me joy. And then obviously all the chaos happens at the yeah. Oscars. The guy with the horrible face has a fucking gun in his camera.
In the camera! And it's like, that was really, that was really mad and ominous. Like, just like him holding it, yeah. that. Oh my god.
It's so cartoonish. It is.
I thought he was going to start grinning gleefully.
Yeah. He's not a subtle villain. And I feel like it's very exciting, but it's also kind of a blur and is dispensed with quite quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
It's sort of, and here's the thing. We don't have much time left in the studio. And I need to have a good 5 minutes on this. I don't like the ending.
The final ending or?
Kind of the way it's all wrapped up. I felt yeah. very cheated. I felt like the film was setting me up with all this talk of samurais and sacrifice and giving your life for another life.
Yeah.
One of them should die.
Yeah.
Like, narratively, one of them should die.
Well, we almost had it with Kevin.
I know!
Didn't we? And yeah, that would have been quite an amazing, powerful ending if
she dies saving him. Yeah, would have been a great flip.
Absolutely.
But for him to like get a bit injured and then him to just sort of like resign from service.
And then somebody else replaces him, this like older guy who's...
Yeah, and then we have this big Casablanca scene with her in the scarf at the airport and he says goodbye. And
she
like,
runs
okay,
off, she gets off the plane. And
I will always love you, all this. Yeah. And she runs off the plane, she kisses him and you're like, oh, so they're together.
Yeah, and then they're not.
And then they're not.
Yeah, we are cheated. I think we are cheated.
We're cheated out of a good death and a good reunion.
A good reunion and a good death, yeah.
It's a nothing ending.
I feel like they chickened out, possibly, for whatever reason. Like, they could have been braver with that ending. But for whatever reason, decided that they wanted a safer ending. And it's a bit like, meh, when you see that final shot of him. I think he's protecting, like, a priest or something.
At a Rotary Club meeting.
And it's just like, please. This is who you're protecting at the moment. You know, it's a bit disappointing.
As a novelist, I wanted to throw my glass at the screen. I was like, no, you've looted the audience.
You've cheated us.
You have to give us something that's been worthy of the narrative you've been building.
Absolutely.
Either they, you know, a car in the sky, or in love. Or
and
one
that
of
would
them
have worked.
Dead.
That would have worked, you know, because it set us up so nicely for that.
Yeah, if she ran off the plane and she was like, I want to be with you, I don't care what it takes to make it work.
Let's be together.
Let's be together. Great.
Yeah.
If she dies, great. If he dies,
either
great.
Way, either one of those would have been really satisfying.
Yeah.
But yeah, we were definitely cheated. I think the end is definitely a letdown for, you know, a good film.
Because I actually always thought, because you know the famous poster of him carrying her.
Yeah.
I always thought that she does die.
Did
I
you? From the poster?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
And that it was a tragic film.
Right.
So I was getting my tragedy sort of gears all oiled up. And then I was like, what?
She doesn't die?
Because it's so leading towards that.
Yeah, like, it's a very loaded poster, actually.
She keeps saying to him, what, you would give your life? I don't think I could do that. I'm like, she's going to sacrifice herself for her.
That's so true. She says that several times in the film. Yeah, yeah,
it's almost like they were leading to that and then switched it. Like, it's like test screenings and then
they change their mind. I feel like something like that must have happened because, like you said, it's foreshadowed within the film. It's said several times in the film. And, you know, we are preparing either for some great romance or for some like tragic loss. And then that doesn't happen. And they kind of have this really like safe, meh ending.
No film that has a shootout at the Oscars can end with a scene at a Rotary Club. That the maths doesn't work.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, it's crazy that they went in that direction. But I mean, obviously the film still did brilliantly.
I mean, iconic.
Yeah, iconic.
Iconic album sales as well.
Yeah.
Like breaking all soundtrack records.
I think it was nearly 9 million or something for I Will Always Love You, that single alone.
Yeah.
That's crazy numbers, you know. That's incredible. Which was originally actually a country song recorded by Dolly Parton. The great and awesome Dolly Parton, who's also wonderful. So it's just interesting to hear like the original and hear Whitney's version because they're very different. And apparently it wasn't actually supposed to be in the film. They had a different song choice originally, but that had been used for another film.
It used to be What Becomes of the Broken Heart.
Yes, that's it. That's the song that was supposed to be in the movie, but interesting, you know, went for that one.
And here's the other thing. I'm sorry. I've been loving on this film consistently, so I think it's okay to hate it now. I think Whitney's version is beautiful, and I'm so familiar with that radio version where it's like it's so she's unaccompanied and it's like just her voice and it's so beautiful, it's so haunting, and this music softly comes in and it's amazing. But like, she never sings it in the film.
This is so true.
Like, you don't get that payoff. You have that moment where they're dancing and they're listening to the country version of it. And they're like, this song's nice. And then you should have that moment where she's singing it to him or something.
Well, I wonder if they felt like it would be too much or that it would have more of an impact sales-wise if they saved it just for like the soundtrack.
Yeah, I suppose if you're still sitting in your seat and the credits are rolling and all you can hear is that like descending over you. Yeah, I
feel like it was clearly a business cynical decision.
Sales of the Bodyguard soundtrack went through the roof. Also, memberships to Rotary Clubs went through the roof.
Well, probably. But
a great year for the Rotary.
Visibility. Great visibility.
We exist. All right, Resin, we should probably wrap up, but tell me all about your everything. You are one of the most awarded short story novelists I've ever met, short story writers I've ever met. What's that like? Oh, I don't have any awards.
Well, that's very... Well, you will do. Just a matter of time. That's very generous of you to say. Yeah, I don't know what to make of that, really. I guess it's encouraging for me because I was always like, I don't know who's going to read these weird experimental short stories in my head. And I've just been lucky to have good champions behind me. And that's helped a lot. You know, people who believe in your voice, you know, people like...
It's so deserved, man. Aww, you're so good.
That's so nice.
I first met you at like a literary showcase that I was hosting.
You were such a fantastic host. Yeah, you were absolutely brilliant. So funny and natural.
I just announced that I had my period on stage.
You were brilliant. I loved it.
It was, yeah. Thank you very much. That was very kind. But I just you were one of the standouts of that night because you were reading from Nudie Branch, which is your short story collection. And you had this story called, I think it was called The Tailor.
Oh, I know the story you're talking about. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What's it called again?
It's now this title's gone out of my head because I own my own
It's
story.
Called The Tailor.
It's a story about a tailor who makes these amazing dresses for women in the town, but they don't know that they can only wear them 3 or 4 times before strange things start to happen.
It's that sort of like ghosty, spooky.
Yeah. Gothic-ish
stuff that it just really, really excites me. And I remember just being so excited by you on the night, and I continue to be so excited.
Nice. That's so nice. What a compliment. Thank you.
Yeah, you're right. It's a huge compliment.
No, I mean, I thought everyone was so good, you know, on the night. It was such an enjoyable evening to be like a part of, like to hear other voices. And
I think it was one of the last evenings before
the end. Before the end. Before life changed as we know it, you know. But what about you doing exciting things? You're polymath writer, journalist, podcaster.
Oh, you know, keeping busy.
Doing it all.
No, I won't brag about myself on this podcast. I do that too much. Renison, thank you so much for coming in. This has been a joy.
Thank you. It's absolutely amazing. I've loved it. I hope I get asked back again.
You've got so much
just
stuff.
Putting it out there.
Your other suggestion, which was so good.
Yeah, we got to do that.
Okay. Yeah. I won't spoil it.
Yes.
That's good. Absolutely. And if anyone wants us to write the Missy Elliott Justin Bieber vehicle, we are here.
Yes, let's do it.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's CZAROLINE, or email me about the podcast at sentimentalpod@gmail.com. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast. Thank you to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the artwork, and Hannah Varro for the mixing.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.